had a new president. The brisk and peppery senator from Missouri, Harry S. Truman, sobered now by the sudden and grave responsibilities he shouldered. He immediately affirmed he would continue the president's efforts for world organization.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. President, members of the Congress, it is with a heavy heart that I stand before you, my friends and colleagues, in the Congress of the United States. Within an hour after I took the oath of office, I announced that the San Francisco Conference would proceed. In the memory of those who have made the supreme sacrifice, in the memory of our fallen president, we shall not fail.
2 weeks later, Secretary of State Stettinius spoke to the representatives of 51 nations gathered in the San Francisco Opera House. I remember from my broadcast spot in the balcony noting the lean figure of the secretary of that organization merely because of his odd first name, Alger. Alger Hiss. We were all to hear of him some years later. Stettinius spoke.
Vision we must have to see clearly that without peace and security for all nations, there will be no peace and security for any one of us. Courage we must have, and faith we must have in the ability of mankind to make peace. That vision and that courage and that faith inspired the great American leader whose life was given for the cause for which we have met, Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
While the statesmen were working at building a peace organization in San Francisco, American and British soldiers were racing inside Germany to meet the Russians coming from the east. Hitler, in a desperate effort at terror, had tried his vengeance weapons, the buzz bombs over London, and then the V-2, the first missiles. General von Rundstedt had gathered forces for one last counteroffensive, this in the Ardennes Forest, the Battle of the Bulge. But at Bastogne, General Tony McAuliffe of the 101st Airborne, completely surrounded, answered a surrender demand by the single word nuts, symbolizing Allied determination. And the Nazi wave receded for the last time. A lucky prize came in the capture of the Remagen Rhine Bridge. Here's the report of the first GI across into Germany, Sergeant Alexander Drabnik.
They told me later that the bridge was only 250 yards across. It seemed like 250 miles. There were 200 platoons ahead of us, but they'd got pinned down part of the way across the bridge, and then they sent us out. There wasn't anybody in front of me.
Now, events tumbled fast. On April 28th, Mussolini and his mistress, Clara Petacci, were caught and hung, fleeing from partisans. 2 days later, as Russian artillery pounded Berlin, Hitler killed himself and his mistress in his bomb-proof bunker. Russian and U.S. forces had met at the Elbe River. Germany was cut in two. For 5 days, we held ourselves breathless and tense while the secret negotiations went on. Then came the announcement. Victory in Europe, VE Day. May 7th.
The Allied force, which invaded Europe on June 6th, 1944, has, with its great Russian allies and forces advancing from the south, utterly defeated the Germans by land, sea, and air.
Eleanor Roosevelt.
It is a day on which my husband would want me to say to you, the soldiers of this country, on all the fields of battle, that he is grateful to each and every one of you.
But let us not forget for a moment the toils and efforts that lie ahead. Japan, with all her treachery and greed, remains unsubdued. Advance Britannia! Long live the cause of freedom!
As the Nazi defenses fell apart, and Allied forces roamed freely for the first time inside Hitler's Germany, a sickening secret was revealed to the world. The concentration camps, which beginning in 1937, Hitler had created for political enemies, foreign prisoners, and especially for mass murder of Jews. Buchenwald, Auschwitz, Dachau. The emaciated prisoners crawled among corpses. Heaps of bones surrounded the death ovens, where over 6 million had died. One of the living rejoins his mother.
This mother will not be able to help you. Only for me, tell you, Aligo Suto Buddha Vinos here. I'll have one no mecanda, Aligo no Sadia, as made me no good. Mommy, mommy.
Now, all our attention was turned to the Pacific. To break Japan as we had Germany by land invasion, our bombers must first reach their land. That meant the march back up the islands. First, the liberation of the Philippines. General MacArthur at Leyte after the great naval battle there.
Mr. President, your office is my dear friends, I have returned.
Next, the airmen bombing Japan from Saipan needed an island base midway for their fighter escorts. The choice was tiny Iwo Jima, 8 square miles of miserable volcanic ash. There would be 7,000 dead and 20,000 wounded in the blazing month of combat that started with the landings on February 19th, and that were immortalized by the photo of the flag raising on Mount Suribachi on the fourth day of the struggle. By a rare coincidence, our Secretary of the Navy, James Forrestal, was eyewitness to that scene.
Up the precipitous side of a 600-foot extinct volcano, so precipitous that it seemed almost vertical, went a platoon of American Marines. Even through a glass, they seemed tiny figures scrambling skyward against a background of blue. And then a few minutes later, from the thousands of throats upon ships and on land and sea, came the sudden cry, "There goes the flag."
Each victory was bought with blood. Okinawa, still nearer Japan, was reached on Easter Sunday, April 1st. Now the desperate Japanese stepped up their kamikaze attacks, suicide flights by specially trained pilots who volunteered to ride down with their bomb load into the target itself. Sure death, but a sure hit. They sank 45 combat ships and damaged 28 carriers. This was only a foretaste of the losses that could be expected on both sides when, inevitably, D-Day for Japan would arrive. Then came unbelievable news. An atom bomb over Japan. The president himself, from the White House, tried to fit this incredible fact into conventional terms.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. We won the race of discovery against the Germans. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
At precisely 9:15 a.m., a blinding flash and a mushroom-shaped cloud that bright morning of August 6th over a Japanese city, and over 60,000 humans were dead. This awesome reality was the result of experiments in utmost secrecy going back to 1939, when a letter from Albert Einstein warned the president that German scientists might be on the road to splitting the atom, their goal, the world's most powerful weapon. The president had then set up the so-called Manhattan Project, which 6 years later culminated at Los Alamos in New Mexico on the 16th of July with the test explosion which marked the dawn of the atomic age, and Hiroshima, the dawn of atomic death. A reporter on Tinian, home base of the atom bomb plane, told of his talk with the crew.
The explosion was a big ball of fire. Anyone not having dark glasses would have received the visual shock several miles away. One of the crew members said, "My God," when he saw what had happened. What had been Hiroshima was a white mountain of smoke, and when we saw it first, it was already up to 25,000 feet. About 1,000 feet off the ground, it looked like boiling dust. It extended over most of the city, churning down there, and the center of the impact was in the center of the city, and the boiling continued several minutes as we watched. Then the mushroom of smoke broke off, and another developed below it. This one bomb is the equivalent of a 2,000 B-29 raid.
President Truman, in ordering the use of the bomb, had weighed the cost in lives lost on both sides if invasion landings were attempted against the fanatically determined Japanese. His surrender terms before Hiroshima continued to be ignored by the Japanese. On August 9th, the second atom bomb, this time over Nagasaki, killed 36,000 more. That same day, Russia declared war on Japan, barely meeting her Yalta deadline. Now again, the suspense we had known just a few months before at VE Day, August 10th, 12th, 13th, no word. And then the president.
I have received this afternoon a message from the Japanese government in reply to the message forwarded to that government by the Secretary of State on August 11th. I deem this reply a full acceptance of the Potsdam Declaration, which specifies the unconditional surrender of Japan. In the reply, there is no qualification.
This time, the nation really went wild. In New York's Times Square, my NBC mobile unit cruised slowly like a peacetime tank through the surging crowd to get me on top of the story. I remember a sailor going up a lamppost-like rigging, wildly waving his cap from the 20-foot top. No girl was safe in Times Square, nor did she want to be, from the kisses of the nearest man. The formal surrender, 2 weeks later, September 2nd. Frock-coated, silk-hatted Japanese approached the table on the deck of the battleship Missouri in Tokyo Bay to hear, along with us, the Supreme Commander, General MacArthur. Alongside him, the British Commander and General Wainwright.
Let us pray that peace be now restored to the world, and that God will preserve it always. These proceedings are closed.
Peace at last, after the greatest war in history. In its 6 years, 80 million men had locked in combat. Almost 20%, 15 million, had died. We alone had over a million casualties. From all this destruction, two outstanding world powers had now emerged, the United States and Russia. There were conferences of the victors in Washington and in Moscow preparing for the peace treaties, but among themselves, the Western allies agreed that the secrets of the A-bomb should not be shared with anyone, meaning Russia, till the newly organized UN could set up overall control. Then word leaked out from diplomatic sources that instead of following the verbal agreements at Yalta to foster representative democratic governments in liberated nations, Stalin was installing puppet governments, communist governments in East Europe, backed up by Soviet troops in those areas. Our great wartime ally was going his own and secret way. On March 6, 1946, Winston Churchill came to President Truman's home state to speak at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri. With the president on the platform, the great wartime prime minister, now a private citizen, made one of the most important speeches of his age and gave us a name for a new boundary between lands and between the two ways of life of our post-war years.
From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe. Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia. All these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet sphere.
In other words, a divided world. So we learned a new phrase, Iron Curtain, quickly followed by another one, Cold War, headquarters, Moscow and Washington. The UN had been born with the atom bomb. It was understandable that reasonable people would try to control this new weapon of unheard of power. Bernard Baruch presented the U.S. plan to the UN.
We of this nation, desirous of helping to bring peace to the world and realizing the heavy obligations upon us arising from our possession of the means of producing the bomb, are prepared to make our full contribution toward effective control of atomic energy. We propose this. One, manufacture of atomic bombs shall stop.
Baruch's other points, destroy all bombs and share our secret know-how with others, provided there was agreed international inspection and control. The Russians said niet. Our Cold War commander, Harry Truman, took decisive action. He pushed through his policy of containment with almost a half billion of economic aid to Greece and Turkey, the Truman Doctrine, then artfully dropped into the commencement address at Harvard in 1947 was the master plan, worked out by General, now Secretary of State, George Marshall.
It is logical that the United States should do whatever it is able to do. to assist in the return of normal economic health in the world. Our policy is directed not against any country or doctrine, but against hunger, poverty, desperation, and chaos, so as to permit the emergence of political and social conditions in which free institutions can exist. Any government that is willing to assist in the task of recovery will find full cooperation, I am sure, on the part of the United States government. Any government which maneuvers to block the recovery of other countries cannot expect help from us.
The Marshall Plan came just in time. France and Italy were on the edge of collapse. Our foreign aid to West Europe mounted into the billions. Stalin realized it would be a mortal blow to our prestige if he could squeeze us out of Berlin. He ordered a blockade of all supply routes. Our occupation commander, Lucius Clay, said, hang on. But how? The Berlin Airlift, a bridge of American and British transports that supplied a great city with all its food, fuel, clothing, everything. For instance, my airlift assignment out of Frankfurt was a plane carrying 2,000 quarts of Danish milk. When I flew back a few days later in an empty C-54, I sat on a floor strewn with remnants of its cargo, dehydrated potatoes. Total, from June 1948, 2.5 million tons in almost a year before Stalin called it quits. At the same time the airlift had started, a smaller but shooting war erupted between Arabs and Jews in the Near East when the State of Israel was proclaimed. Radio continued to bring us highlights, even if the battles were now diplomatic, like this tense UN vote in 1949 over the admission of the new State of Israel. Australia's Herbert Evatt, President of the General Assembly.
The voting is as follows. In favor of the resolution recommended by the ad hoc committee, 37, against 12, abstentions 9, every member of the United Nations being present and taking part in the vote. That satisfies the requirement of the Charter of a two-thirds majority, and I therefore formally declare Israel admitted to membership in the United Nations.
Full membership in the family of nations for the people whom we had heard 18 months before in Tel Aviv greeting their first step to independence, the UN partition plan, this way.
They're starting to sing Hatikva, the Jewish national anthem. All around me, I can see Jews weeping unashamed while they sing. Let's listen to them.
The Cold War could not be fought without a master plan and mutual commitments. A major step was made in the North Atlantic Treaty between 12 Western nations, NATO. Britain's Foreign Minister Ernest Bevin hailed it.
At last, democracy is no longer a series of isolated units. It has become a cohesive organism determined to fulfill its great purpose.
Far across the world, in India, assassination had struck down one of the most inspiring and original personalities of the age, Mahatma Gandhi. The little bird-like man, strange to us in his sheet-like robes, and yet who commanded world respect.
I regard myself as a soldier, though a soldier of peace. I know the value of discipline and truth.
Just 5 months before, his beloved India had won independence. His heir and disciple, Jawaharlal Nehru, spoke.
Friends and comrades, the light has gone out of our lives, and there is darkness everywhere. And I do not quite know what to tell you and how to say it. Our beloved leader, Bapu as we called him, the father of the nation, is no more.
But what gave the event special meaning for the West with our atom bomb monopoly was the words of atom scientist Albert Einstein.
I believe that Gandhi's views were the most enlightened of all the political men in our time. We should strive to do things in his spirit, not to use violence in fighting for our cause, but by non-participation in anything you believe is evil.
Perhaps the greatest sports figure of all time died in 1948. Babe Ruth. The year before, we heard a tribute to him at the house that Ruth built, Yankee Stadium. As he responded, his voice was hoarse with his fatal illness.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. You know how bad my voice sounds. Well, it feels just as bad. You know this baseball game of ours comes up from the youth. The only real game, I think, in the world, baseball.
Baseball always for Americans. And in the post-war 40s, bands, dozens of them on the air now. So a sampling is safest if we choose old favorites like...
What good is melody? What good is music if it ain't possessing something sweet? Now it ain't the melody and it ain't the music. There's something else that makes this tune complete. Yes, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Well, don't mean a thing. All you got
Satchmo,
to do is
of course.
Sing.
Louis Armstrong. And Count Basie. Of all the big bands going back in our radio recollections through the 20s, Paul Whiteman. Time for nostalgia now. The first peacetime election in 8 years looms. The Republicans at Philadelphia choose the able governor of New York State, Tom Dewey.
In all humility, I accept the nomination. I am happy to be able to say to you that I come to you unfettered by a single obligation or promise to any living person.
2 weeks later, in the same hall, the Democrats settle not too hopefully on their titular leader, the president himself. At once, he sets the keynote for his campaign.
Senator Barkley and I will win this election and make these Republicans like it. Don't you forget that.
They didn't forget it. Nobody forgot it. In the political upset of the era, barnstorming, whistle-stopping, give-em-hell Harry figured to lose badly to a confident Dewey, and with a split in the Democratic South, captured over 50% of the popular vote and a Democratic Congress as well. He recalled his own experiences of the election night broadcasts with this classic comment.
I had my sandwich and glass of buttermilk and went to bed at 6:30. And along about 12 o'clock, I happened to wake up for some reason, and the radio was turned on, and Mr. Kelton Barnes was saying, "Well, the president is a million votes ahead in the popular vote. We have yet to get." And we are very sure that when the country vote comes in, Mr. Truman will be defeated by another funding vote. And I went back to bed and went to sleep.
2 years later, in 1950, the comparative international calm was shattered by the communist invasion of South Korea. It broke on the last Sunday in June. President Truman made a lightning move. That very afternoon, we broadcasters were at the Security Council, listening to U.S. Representative Warren Austin presenting charges of aggression and calling for collective U.N. action.
The Security Council recommends
that the members of the United Nations furnish such assistance to the Republic of Korea as may be necessary to repel the armed attack and to restore international peace and security in the area.
The Russians, who had absented themselves, couldn't veto, and a UN force was approved. General MacArthur, who had led the occupation of Japan, was commander. The war seesawed for over a year. MacArthur made policy statements from the field and was finally recalled by President Truman. To Congress, he made his famed old soldier's speech.
But I still remember the refrain which proclaimed most proudly that old soldiers never die. They just fade away. And like the old soldier of that ballad, I now close my military career and just fade away.
The Korean War quickly ground to a stalemated armed truce along the 38th parallel. The nation was saddened by the loss of life, over 30,000. A change was needed, and the Republicans felt they had the right man when they nominated General Eisenhower. The Democrats picked a new personality, Governor Adlai Stevenson of Illinois.
And now, my friends, that you have made your decision, I will fight to win that office with all my heart and my soul.
Stevenson was overwhelmed in a big victory for the Eisenhower-Nixon ticket. From his home in Springfield, we had a taste of his grace and wit.
Someone asked me as I came in down on the street how I felt. And I was reminded of a story that a fellow townsman of ours used to tell, Abraham Lincoln. And they asked him how he felt once after an unsuccessful election. He said he felt like a little boy who had stubbed his toe in the dark, that he was too old to cry, but it hurt too much to laugh.
A new phenomenon now began to preoccupy the American scene, the congressional investigation, undoubtedly a product of Cold War tensions. In the late 40s, editor Whitaker Chambers had charged that high State Department official Alger Hiss had been a secret communist under the name Carlson. Hiss denied it. There was this confrontation.
Mr. Hiss, would you kindly stand up, please?
Chambers, can you stand up?
Have you ever seen this individual who is standing?
I have.
Do you know him?
I identify him as
who?
As George Carlson.
The number and scope of the investigation snowballed. Then audiences began building under the added impact of television, which had burgeoned in the early 50s. The Kefauver Crime Investigations, the House Un-American Activities Committee, and the Army-McCarthy hearings, which brought center stage on the TV screens of millions of American homes, the nation's most active communist hunter, Senator Joseph McCarthy, and the contrasting figure of the dignified, bow-tied lawyer from Boston, Joseph Welch. When the hearings began in April of 1954, McCarthy was in full form.
The documents show very clearly that Mr. Symington came back on this committee to try and wreck our attempts to expose communists who had infiltrated his administration. In common decency, Mr. Chairman, in common honesty, he should have given these facts to this committee. He can't conceivably sit here as a fair judge.
You may have it, sir. Will not be
Senator McCarthy, I did not know, Senator. Senator, sometimes you say, may I have your attention?
I'm listening to you. You said Senator McCarthy didn't know.
May I have your attention?
I can listen in one ear and talk.
Now, this time, sir,
okay.
I want you to listen with both.
All right, good.
I will not discuss it further. I will not ask Mr. Cohen any more witnesses. You, Mr. Chairman, may, if you will, call the next witness.
Are there any questions to come from the members of the judge?
2 years later, in November 1956, just before Eisenhower was reelected, and in the midst of a midnight session at the UN General Assembly over the Suez Crisis, our chief representative at the UN, Henry Cabot Lodge, was handed a slip of paper. I saw him read it, his face reddening with surprise and anger. Then he rose and walked rapidly to the podium, asking for the floor. He was almost breathless as he spoke.
Russian gangsters have betrayed us. They are opening fire on all of Budapest. And I sat here and heard the remark of the representative of the Soviet Union about stopping bloodshed in Egypt. Well, Mr. President, the Lord knows that I want to stop bloodshed in Egypt. But I think there was a cynicism about his talking about it at the very moment that they were shedding blood in Budapest, which will horrify everybody who knows about it.
The picture of Lodge shaking with anger, or later pointing sardonically to a Russian microphone hidden in a carved eagle from our Moscow embassy walls. Most of our high spots were coming to us now by TV, but not this one. That strange, unearthly sound was just that, unearthly, out of this world. The transmitter beeping away on Russia's Sputnik, the first man-made satellite, 183 pounds orbiting the Earth every 96 minutes. October 4th, 1957, the space age had arrived.